Hello and welcome to episode 19 of Track. At Track, our aim is to shine a light on the UK running club scene. This week on Track, we have a busy show during which we will discuss the latest race results, including those from the European Indoor Selection Trials in Manchester and the subsequent team selection, some lightning quick 10,000 metre times at the 10 in California. The shoe debate continues with some recent comments in regard to Mark Scott's 10,000 metre performance. British Athletics cop some flack because of a lack of a live stream for the European Indoor Trials. There does appear to be some light at the end of the tunnel for the return of non-elite racing and park run. And at the end of the show, we have an interview with a man who has PBs of 13.47 for 5K, 28.57 for 10K, 63.15 for the half, and 2.20 for the marathon, Jack Gray. As always, I'm joined by Kat, George and Robbie. And actually, since we last spoke, we've had a couple of birthdays in Team Track. One of Team Track turned 20, and another one of Team Track turned significantly older than 20. So, George and Robbie, happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Robbie, do you get anything nice for your birthday?
I thought you'd ask George first, actually. That makes me look back and want to be 20 again. What did you get, George? And then I'll tell you what I got.
I got everything Eliud Kipchoge, basically. I've got the Eliud Kipchoge running jacket and the Eliud Kipchoge t-shirt. And then the main present was the Kipchoge Alpha Flies. So need to find a race now. But yeah, basically Eliud Kipchoge special birthday.
When you're 20, you get a load of Eliud Kipchoge merch. And then when you're 39, you get some hand warmers to go in your gloves, some hot sauce. The only running related thing I got was a hat with a light in it, because I was continually moaning about how I couldn't keep my head torch still on the golf course. So that's what you've got to look forward to, George, in 19 years. You make the most of your Kipchoge years and your exciting presence, because it's all downhill from here, mate.
Well, happy birthday to the both of you. Kat, how are you? Everything okay?
Yeah, all good. Nothing really new.
You're training well?
Still going okay. Starting to build in more sessions, so yeah, I'll try another time trial at the weekend to see where I'm at.
What distance will that be?
5K again. Okay. Same loop.
Speaking of time trials, George, last time you spoke about you're going to have a crack at a 10-mile time trial. You've done that now. How did it go?
Yeah, very well, thank you. So yeah, I did that on Saturday morning. Perfect weather for it. I don't think I've ever had, it always seems to be windy in Loughborough. I don't think I've ever had a day where it was that still and perfect temperature in the end of February. So no excuses, which isn't, sometimes it's nice to have an excuse to fall back on. But no, I did 10-mile time trial, sort of a time trial. So I wanted the first 7 miles at sort of a half marathon effort that I thought I could carry on for another, well, for 13 miles. And then hopefully still feel pretty good at 7 miles and pick it up for the last three. So I ended up doing first 7 miles at 5:12 a mile, and then the last three at 5 minute miling, basically. So came to 51:28 for the 10 miles, which was, yeah, really, really pleased with. And yeah, say perfect conditions. Had a friend out site on the bike. We did the Loughborough Industrial Estate, a 1K loop. So just laps of that, and nice to have some company on the bike. And yeah, really pleased.
How did you feel at the end of it, George? Did you feel like you'd, at the end of a race, or did you feel like you could kind of go again?
I think the way I ran it, it was only the last 3 miles that were really hard. I mean, I could feel it the first 7 miles. It wasn't like I was going easy, but I didn't feel like I'd raced flat out for 10 miles, but the last three were hard. I think my last 3 miles were something like 5:05, 5 flat, 4:58 or something like that. So yeah, the last 3 miles hurt, but I definitely felt at 7 miles that I had enough in me to do another six.
What was the Tom Evans banter between you two that I saw? I couldn't quite follow it. Was he doing a session on the same course on the same day or something?
Slightly different course. So him, Frank and Kevin Seawood, Frank Baddick and Kevin Seawood, were doing, they did a 22-mile tempo sort of run, and they did you can extend the industrial estate to go kind of up a main road and do like a 2 mile loop. I wanted to stick on the industrial estate, and they offered that I could jump in with them if I wanted to. But I thought, because I wanted to go off feel the first 7 miles and be in control of the pace, that I'd just be better off doing it solo, even though obviously it's harder solo, but just so I could completely control the pace.
Big dog running, George, turning down Tom Evans and Frank Paddock.
Well, I mean, turning down or too nervous to jump in with them. I don't know which. I mean, probably the latter.
What things are you, Ben?
Yeah, fine. Thanks, Robbie. Much like Kat, really. Training's ticking along nicely. Another couple of good weeks. Good mileage, good sessions, feeling good in the sessions as well. So I'm just trying to sort of quietly go about it and stack week on week without doing anything too amazing, but just sort of tick along and, yeah, train sensibly.
And Wrexham's 100% on, I'd have thought, with the announcement and the timeline set out by the government.
Well, not officially 100% on. We haven't had actually confirmation from Wrexham, the organisers, because the Welsh government haven't actually done the same yet. That being said, people who are organising Wrexham Marathon have two courses that they can use effectively. If the Welsh government are happy for races to go ahead, it will happen in Wrexham. If they're not happy for races to go ahead, hopefully it can be moved just across the border into Cheshire, I believe, and there's another course in England that they can hopefully use. So they're trying everything for it to happen, basically. Okay, guys, should we have a look into some of the results, some of the elite results that have happened over the last couple of weeks? The first one we're going to look at, I think, sort of the most prominent event that's taken place was on the weekend of February the 21st, and that was the European Indoor Selection Trials, which was held in Manchester. And George, you're going to take us through the men's results, and Kat, you're going to highlight some of the women's results for us.
Weren't official trials. It wasn't if you finished in a particular position, you'd definitely get picked. But it was just an opportunity for the best athletes to run fast times and prove themselves against each other. So the men's 3,000 metres, Jack Rowe won in 7:54. Somewhat surprising, maybe. Andy Butchart, who came second in 7:56, followed by Phil Sessman in 7:57. And they are the three that go into the European indoors. And then in fourth was Emil Caress, fifth, Johnny Davis, sixth, Ross Millington, seventh, Ewan Thomas, and eighth, Sol Sweeney. In the men's 1500, Piers Copeland won in 3:52. Archie Davis came second in 3:52 as well. So 3:52.1 for Piers Copeland, 3:52.9 for Archie Davis. They're both going to the European indoors. George Mills came third in 3:53, and then followed by Tom Keane, Joe Ewing, Andy Butchart as well, around the 1500, and then Sol Sweeney. And then in the men's 800, just three runners. Guy Learmonth won in 1:47.8. He's going to the European indoors. Men in second was Ben Patterson, and third, Alex Bottrell in 1:50 and 1:51. And Copeland and Davis will be joined by Neil Gawley in the 1500, and Guy Learmonth will be joined by Jamie Webb for the European indoor.
So in the women's 3000, we had Verity Ockenden, another really impressive performance by her. A great race to watch, obviously not live streamed, but it's available on YouTube now. Really good to see. She looked comfortable throughout and only took the lead in the last 100 metres to win in 8:56. Amelia Quirk was second in 8:58. We also had Jenny Nesbitt, friend of the show, in that race, finished in 9:09, which is an indoor PB for her. She said it was painful, but a big improvement from my last time out, hoping to stay in one piece for the next race. So she took 8 seconds off her 3,000 metres in January, so she's probably, or hopefully, pleased with that. Verity Ockenden said she's on a roll, and that she was really glad she had raced the week before and grateful for Vincente Madel for putting on that race. And also she messaged saying she stuck to Harajuku Girls for the pre-race track. She's going to stick, trying to replicate everything from the previous week. Obviously, that race had also gone really well. So, yeah, she's really running really well, big talent, and she's selected for the 3,000 metres at the European indoors, and so is Amelia Quirk from that race, alongside Amy Louise Markov as well. In the 1500, it was won by Holly Archer in 4:13, and closely behind by Katie Snowden in 4:13.16, both selected for the 1500 metres.
Those, as we said, that is for the European indoors, which is taking place 5th, 6th and 7th of March, I believe, in Poland. You guys have pretty much mentioned who will be going to that from a British perspective, but we'll go through it very quickly anyway. We said Elliot Giles has withdrawn, Mark Scott has withdrawn. He said he's going to focus on training in the US and on a 5K in March. And as you said, George, Phil Seisman has replaced Mark Scott. We should also give a big shout out to Joel Clark-Kahn of Worcester AC, who will be going to the European Indoor. So massive congratulations to Joel. Another great sort of story for Worcester AC and all the hard work and training that he's put in over the lockdown period and prior to that. So well done, Joel. Let me just run through the team very, very quickly for the distance. So as we said, 800 metres, Guy Learmonth and Jamie Webb. 1500 metres, Pierce Copeland, Archie Davis and Neil Gurley. 3000 metres, Andrew Butcher, Jack Rowe and now Phil Seisman. And in the women's side of things, as Kat has mentioned, in the 800, it's going to be Ellie Baker, Isabel Boffey and Keely Hodgkinson. In the 1500 metres, Holly Archer and Katie Snowden. 3000 metres, Amelia Quirk, Verity Ockenden and Amy Eloise Markovic. I suppose one of the big talking points and one of the big reactions on that event in Manchester, however, and it was a talking point amongst athletes, commentators and fans on social media, was the fact that actually there was no live stream to watch those trials. Some fairly outspoken remarks, as including some people we've previously spoken to on the show, including Aaron Scott, Chris Barnes and also Graham Rush was another name, highlight their disappointment at the fact there was no live stream to watch that event. We actually saw Jenny Nesbitt stream the men's 3,000 metres on her own Instagram Live. One of the reasons that was given for there not being a live stream was that there was not enough staff for that to take place. But actually, if you see some of the tweets, so for example, a tweet from James Rhodes, who was there, he actually tweeted a photo of sort of lots of people standing on the sidelines. And he tweeted, "The argument of not having the people available to live stream is flawed. I can count multiple, brackets, not distance people, just standing around." So Graham Rush said, "Why no live stream? This is 2021. We've had no athletics for a year and you can't manage to set up a stream. Very disappointing." Aaron Scott said, "Once again, it's left to the athletes to showcase themselves via a stream on Instagram. If the governing body can't even help market the sport any longer, then what really is the point in them? COVID is no excuse here. Somebody needs to step up and save our sport." And then Graham Rush came back and said, "No appreciation of top-down or bottom-up, grassroots or elite. I'm staggered by how little in a year British athletics appear to have done to support the sport." As ever, Chris Barnes of Podium 5K also sort of highlighted his disappointment. Again, on Twitter, he said, "There are millions of runners that have had nothing this year, and almost nothing for 11 months. British athletics had an amazing opportunity to take. They have dissed themselves even more today." Start with you, Robbie. What do you think about the live stream issue?
Nothing that we can particularly say that hasn't already been said, because it's just unforgivable that that wasn't live streamed. I mean, from kind of our point of view, I know, Kat, you put a couple of messages out to our kind of little group and also on our club Facebook site saying, "Does anybody know where you can live stream it?" And I was almost just waiting for somebody just to send a link and then that be that, because it must have so obviously it was going to be kind of shown. It's almost impossible to get your head around why they didn't do it. I don't know why they're overcomplicating it. I don't know why they weren't able to do it. And obviously the other angle from obviously Podium 5K's point of view as well, which Chris has pointed out in his tweets, is that Chris got completely hauled over the coals for photos of his Podium 5K back in, was it August, when that when just came out of lockdown, a few pictures kind of floating around of people he had no control over whatsoever, perhaps not socially distancing round the side of kind of watching on, and yet there are photos released of people within a controlled environment not socially distancing. I mean, the whole thing's just bit of a shit show, really. Bit embarrassing.
Yeah, it's just baffling because, yeah, Graham Rush said it's 2021, it's not difficult. You just need someone stood by the phone, really, and that's about it. I mean, so there are races now on YouTube, are there?
Yeah, you can watch them all now, and I don't know why couldn't that live stream. It's good.
Someone did film them.
Yeah, they were there ready to be released. I mean, even a 5 minute delay would have been acceptable, but it, yeah.
Yeah. So like the no staff, no, not enough staff, like is the reason. No live, like, yet there was someone there filming it. They just.
I mean, the previous week they used the same stadium and it was fully live streamed by one man up in the stands on his iPhone. And I think at the previous event, he dropped his iPhone during filming and somebody trackside picked it up and carried on filming. I mean, we're not asking for, you know, amazing BBC coverage, just somebody to hold their phone up at it so we can watch it live. I just can't understand why they couldn't organise that. It's quite disrespectful to the athletes who are trying to make a career out of running to not promote them at all. And not even, you know, why couldn't they just let somebody in to film it? Just say, okay, New Balance Manchester filmed the last one. Can you come in and just stand there with your iPhone?
Yeah, exactly. And like, went to a university competition at Lee Valley like this time last year. And I live streamed one of the races, the men's 1500, I think it was, or 800, to Facebook live, just stood there with my phone. It's not difficult. I mean, it's a tiny arena, it's only a 200 meter track, so you could even just put a phone in the corner or a camera in the corner and you'd see the whole arena.
Jenny's coverage was pretty good at first. It was a little bit like, oh, I can't work out what's going on, but within a few laps you're like, yep, I can see who everyone is. It's not difficult.
I wonder whether you just hit the nail on the head there, Kat. Right, I wonder whether they just kind of over complicated it and thought that it needed to be something more polished and, you know, more kind of overproduced than it actually needs to be.
Off to editing and...
Exactly, yeah, and Steve Crown kind of...
But, like, the videos, they've had, like, 800 views, one of the videos I watched today. And you think that, on the day, probably would have had so many more views of people actually keen to watch it live. But, you know, you've only just found out that they're on YouTube. It just it's not very modern to take it back, edit it for days, and then send out a video.
I think they need to realise as well that we've all got pretty low standards for what we'll watch as runners. I mean, some of the discussions that we've had over the last few months about kind of trying to follow footage, and you know, we're pretty much so starved of kind of race day, you know, kind of atmosphere and watching anything live, that we'll pretty much just sit there and watch a lone runner for 2.5 hours from a front on kind of camera. So why they thought that they couldn't just kind of put a camera in and instantly kind of get a big audience, I don't know. They just must be so out of touch that they just didn't see it.
Hold on to those thoughts, because shortly after that event, Tom Bedford, who is organising the marathon Olympic trials at Kew, actually tweeted out looking for sponsors so that they could stream the Kew Olympic trials race. So it sounds as if there's nothing organised just yet for that to be live streamed. So it maybe we're having this conversation again in a few weeks' time, but hopefully that can get sorted. And I would think Tom Bedford, having seen the backlash of the indoors, he would probably be doing his very best to get a live stream for that race now. I mean, and in fact, in fairness, that's probably going to be more difficult because it's a bigger venue, it's outdoors, it's, you know, a larger loop. We'll see what comes out from that.
To be honest, I won't be able to watch that anyway because I'll be at work. It's at 9 o'clock on a Friday morning, isn't it? So I'm not so bothered about that one.
Yeah, that's true. So we'll see what happens there. Okay, thanks, guys. Robbie, do you want to take us quickly through Mark Scott's and others' performances at the 10 on the 20th?
Yeah, so this was on the 20th of February over in California, and it was a event kind of put on by Sound Running and dominated by Bowman Tracker, basically. So they basically come together in really simple format, 10,000 meter women's race, 10,000 meter men's race, with the idea to get people Olympic qualifying times. The result was kind of lightning quick times, two absolutely brilliant races and two outstanding performances by British runners. So Mark Scott in the men's race ran the second fastest 10,000 meters in history, behind Mo Farah. And then Elish McColgan ran an absolutely amazing performance, and she ran the second fastest Scottish women's 10,000 metre in history, behind a couple of seconds behind her own mum, Liz McColgan. So the women's race went off first. It was paced to meet the Olympic standard of 31:25. McColgan sat in with the lead group, who were all Bowerman ladies, until about five laps to go. And then Elise Cranny and Carissa Schweitzer kind of took over from there, really, and ran a pretty amazing last five laps, where they were kind of untouchable and came home in times that were the third spot on the US all-time list and the fourth spot on the all-time list. So they basically finished together, Cranny taking the win. McColgan pretty much ran solo for the last kind of four laps particularly. So it was an incredibly brave performance. And she kind of came out afterwards and spoke of her kind of gratitude for the Bowerman kind of pacing, and she was able just to kind of latch on to them. And she finished in a time of 30:58. In the men's, Mark Scott again kind of made the headlines, and another just unbelievable performance from Mark Scott. So like I said, he ran the second quickest UK 10,000 metres of all time, and took the win kind of outright. And he ran 27:10. Mo Farah's got the quickest 10,000 metres in history, 26:46. Just a little bit about the men's race. So that was actually to show the kind of calibre and what a brilliant kind of format it was. He was paced by steeplechase Olympic silver medalist Evan Jaeger and Sean McGaughty. Just a little bit on Mark Scott, really. So he's obviously now the record holder, British record holder for 5K on the road, which he got a podium last year. He's a European record holder for the 5,000 metres indoor. And obviously now he's the second fastest British 10,000 metre. What does he have to do to kind of get into the mainstream sports kind of conscious, do you think?
Win an Olympic medal, I think, would be the only way to do it. Most of the general public have no idea that any of this is happening. The only reason Mo Farah was so famous is because he won four Olympic golds. Laura Muir, okay, she's not won an Olympic medal, but she's won global medals. Yeah, he needs to translate these fast time trial type performances into championship performances, which is why it's a bit of a shame he's withdrawn from European indoors. But I suppose it's all about Tokyo for him now. So it's going to be tough in the 10,000 metres, and maybe he's got a better chance in the five. That I've, it's very tough. But I think that's the only way to get into the general public view.
An interesting illustration, I think, Robbie, was that on the BBC Sport article about the event, Ailish McColgan was the headline and the photo. And I'm not even sure, I think Mark Scott might have been mentioned as a footnote at the end of that article. I'm wondering if Ailish McColgan is more of a story because of her mother, perhaps people know her mother. And so she is known somewhat through that, not to take anything away from her fantastic career in running. You're right, Mark Scott does seem to be very much under the radar. I think George is absolutely right. I think for sort of the wider public to know him and appreciate him, he needs to win medals. But even then, I think even within the running world, he seems to be a little bit under the radar. I wonder if he's just doesn't publicise himself much at all, which is absolutely fine. I wonder if it's in part because he's been over in America since being quite young. I don't know if that plays a role. He's also within a team of superstars, I suppose, in the running world, or close to superstars, at least in America. So does he get lost in that mix a bit? You could argue that it might elevate him. But it's an interesting one. All in all, he seems like a nice fella, down to earth. So it'd be nice for him to get a bit more recognition, wouldn't it?
In Tim Hutchinson's tweets directly about kind of Mark Scott, and also about kind of the shoe discussion at the moment, he was almost... He kind of alluded to the fact that he was surprised that Mark Scott had been able to run that time, and almost like he'd come out of the blue. And I saw somebody had responded really well to it with his kind of chronological kind of ascent into this position. It's not like he's just come out of the blue. So, which I suppose takes us into the kind of shoe debate that it's always rumbling on, but it's kind of kicked on recently with the return of track racing in particular. So this is all kind of kicked off by Tim Hutchinson's tweets afterwards, which obviously everyone kind of is going to have an opinion, but I found it reasonably offensive to Mark Scott, and he obviously kind of stood his ground and But I think when you kind of pinpoint an athlete and absolutely kind of name them and name the performance and almost call it on the shoes and the reason for it was the shoes, and I think you're almost straying into kind of getting personal, really.
I'll read out the tweet, Robbie, just to give people a bit of context if they haven't seen it. So Tim Hutchins, who is a former athlete and athletics commentator now, sort of quoting someone else's tweet who said Mark Scott continues his rise to the top, world class, winning the 10,000 meters in 27:10, second of all time, etc., etc. And then Tim Hutchinson said, seriously, question mark, despite the inevitable focus of plaudits on individual athletes, this isn't meant to be personal. I don't know Mark Scott, and I'm sure he's a good bloke who trains hard and smart, but these big PBs pour out of one track meet after another, and still nothing is done. Hashtag shoes. And there were plenty of replies to that, most of which sort of supporting Mark Scott, I suppose, or at least saying it's not all about the shoes. And then Mark Scott himself replied saying, you're right, Tim. I have trained hard and smart for years and it's finally showing. Maybe time to get off your high horse and give athletes some credit where it's due rather than consistently nag about the shoe technology. So, I mean, this debate just goes on and on and on. And I think the shoes probably need to be spoken about, but it's how they are spoken about.
I just don't understand people's obsession with having to compare different eras. There's so many differences between Elliot Giles and what he's running in and what are the resources he has available and Seb Coe years ago. I mean, it's just, there's so many differences and shoes are one of them. I've got these spikes. I've raced in them. I raced in them last season. They're not that. I was almost, the first time I wore them, a bit disappointed because I'd heard amazing things about them and they weren't that different. I think they're a lot more protective than normal spikes. So I ran 8:29 for the 3K last year and I don't think I ran quicker than I would have done in any other spikes. But that race was my fifth race in about 2 weeks. So I don't think I'd have been able to do that time in other spikes because I think I would have been, the track races would have been taking more out of me in other spikes is what I think the main difference is. I mean, they probably are a little bit quicker, but I don't think they're massively quicker. I just think they are more comfortable to run in, more protective, probably recover quicker. I didn't feel anywhere near as like beat up the next day just because of the foam they've got on them. So see a problem with that. And I think that's a really good thing because if runners can race more, get injured less, you can then showcase the best athletes on TV with good coverage more often, get them racing more often. You know, the Chapter guys, the Ingebretsons, all the best athletes, get them on TV a lot, get them racing a lot without getting injured. And I think they're a really good thing for the sport. And if they run a little bit faster than someone in the 1980s did, then why does it matter? Like, Roger Bannister is probably like a thousandth on the all-time list, but it doesn't mean he wasn't very good. Like, it's just, there's so many reasons why people are running faster now than they were 30 years ago, and the spikes are just one of them.
Completely agree about the shoes only being kind of one part of it. So Mark Scott runs for Bowerman, who are pretty much the most kind of professional and most kind of applied running team in the world, arguably. The difference between, so take him and kind of Dave Bedford, obviously from the kind of 80s and the 70s, 80s era. So the sports science and the knowledge about recovery and training and the different kind of areas that you can get advice from and the different people that you can pull advice on, surely that gives you more of a game, more of an advantage than wearing a different pair of shoes. So people kind of like to kind of talk about the glorious era of Dave Bedford eating kind of fryers before kind of cross-country races and, you know, or you know, drinking a couple of pints the night before a track race and then kind of setting a record. Well, surely the attitude to, you know, like I said, sports science and nutrition and the body and everything goes with that must be the biggest kind of advantage that these runners have. And you get the impression over the last kind of year as well, that's almost become even more kind of in focus because it's obviously the races haven't been there. So everyone's kind of looked at the conditioning side of things and the nutritional side of things, and to kind of see if they can kind of make those gains and where the advantages can be made.
A couple of people I would sort of direct listeners to, if they are interested, from a scientific perspective on some of the potential benefits of the shoes. Ross Tucker is someone who's interesting to look up and takes a very scientific view of it. The other article that I would direct listeners to is one in the Irish Examiner. It's by a guy called Cathal Dennehy, and he's written an article entitled Welcome to the Age of the Super Shoes, and it's quite balanced. And I think he raises a really some really nice points. And he basically says, in truth, it's an insult to athletes of the past to suggest new age technology is not a factor. He said, it's also an insult to the athletes of the present to shout shoes in their face the very moment the years of hard work have come to fruition. Technology is a factor, but it's one of many. He also said, it should be a necessary footnote when dissecting a big performance rather than the headline news. And I think that was probably people's main issue with Tim Hutchins' comment, both the personal nature of it and the fact that it was the main headline. And he finishes off with, these super spikes aren't going away, and I believe every track world record will fall in the next 5 years as a result. And while they will completely distort the all-time lists and force us to recalibrate what we once thought of as fast, the sooner we start doing that, the better. So that's a really nice article, well-balanced, in the Irish Examiner.
And I think one of the things, the last thing that I thought about it is what we need to be careful about, and what World Athletics in particular needs to be careful about, is they don't let the shoes cover up potential other reasons for fast times in the sport. And I'm not saying like any of these results or any recent results down to drugs, but there has been a lot less testing recently. And we just need to be careful, World Athletics needs to be careful that like they don't only look at shoes as the reasons for fast times. There are other reasons, and to sell the sport and make it more popular, we need good coverage and make it exciting and get kind of market our biggest names in the sport properly, and we need the sport to be clean.
Nice point to finish on. Okay, guys, let me just run through a couple of very other quick news articles. Hopefully racing's back on the calendar in the coming months after a COVID roadmap has been announced for athletics, and that can be found on the England Athletics website. And basically, as the timeline suggests, by the end of March, we should be seeing some events and training take place, and hopefully by June, things are back to normal. We also saw Parkrun release a suggested time frame when they will be back in the UK. And the headline there is that all 5K Parkrun events across England will hopefully return on, say, the 5th of June, 2021. And I suppose the last news story we're going to focus on today and spend a bit of time on is the negative news that I'm sure lots of listeners have seen, that Sarah McDonald, a story. So Sarah McDonald, who's a great British athlete, who is training for the 1500 metres, I believe, for the upcoming Tokyo Olympics, was assaulted on a canal side whilst out training in Birmingham. So this is from the BBC website. An athlete who competes for Great Britain says she has been left in a state of shock after being assaulted at a canal side whilst training for the Olympics. Middle distance runner Sarah McDonald had her backside grabbed by a man on a moped while warming up in Birmingham. So Sarah McDonald shared her story on social media and said she's received an overwhelming response to her sharing that. She's going to report the matter to the police, or has done. And really what Sarah McDonald's tweet highlighted is that it sort of prompted other women to come forward and to share their stories of harassment whilst out running. So basically she said, I think it's quite common to have things shouted at you and catcalls. She said, I normally don't speak about these things, but on this occasion I had to make an exception, have been overwhelmed by the response. Until that incident, I'd have felt comfortable being on my own, but this has been a wake-up call, and people need to be vigilant and look after each other. And actually, this followed a story recently from Welsh athletes who have also been sort of highlighted the fact that they've been verbally abused by strangers while they train in public during the lockdown and whilst tracks are closed.
Yeah, I was really pleased that she decided to highlight this, because I think it is something that happens to women. There was a time in Worcester where there was someone going around on a bike grabbing female runners' bums around by the river, and it was a time, you know, where you had to be extra careful out and about. And I don't think there's a easy way to stop that sort of behaviour, but I think her coming out and making it really public might just get to a few people and make them realise, you know, quite how bad what they're doing is. And so I was really pleased that she did go public with it, which probably wasn't an easy thing to do. But yeah, it is one of the things that as female runners, you have to consider every run, where you can run, where's safe to run at the time you're running. It's just the other day out running with Debbie, we decided to go back down the river at sunset at a time where normally we'd run through town, because we're together, we said, oh, as we're together, let's go down by the river, it's nice. But it is just one of those things, being a female and running, you have to always consider where you choose to run. But yeah, good to see someone go public about it and hopefully raise more awareness.
The really sad bit about the story as well is the fact that she said that she's just so used to kind of catcalls and shouts that she's almost just takes that in her stride and she just doesn't even think about it, which is, I mean, it's just such a disgusting place to be, isn't it? That's the kind of benchmark for kind of normal behaviour. You know, and it usually is, obviously, you know, let's face it, it is always a type, isn't it? It's always kind of blokes, either groups of lads or groups of, dare I say it, kind of men in vans are willing to kind of shout and heckle and, you know, but it's just, I don't know, it just seems so out of time and so outdated.
Yeah, well, as you say, it's a shame we're having these conversations, but hopefully actually the conversations result in something positive, and good for other females to feel like they can share their stories in light of Sarah McDonald sharing hers and the Welsh athlete sharing theirs as well. We do have a nice interview this week, Robbie. You sat down with Jack Gray a week or so ago and had a good conversation with Jack.
Yeah, so Jack is, obviously most people know who Jack Gray is. So Jack's currently running for Cambridge, formerly of Brat. So he's a Birmingham-born runner. So somebody that we've kind of come across in, you know, races around around Birmingham League cross-country fixtures and county championships. Jack's always been kind of incredibly talented, but has undoubtedly kind of gone up a level since moving to Cambridge in 2017. So since then, he's represented England. And then before COVID, was kind of enjoying amazing kind of consistent success on the road, tracking, also the cross-country as well. So yeah, so he's, I mean, I seem to kind of say the same things about a lot of our interviewees kind of week in, week out, don't we? But another just really down-to-earth, nice guy who gave up his time on a Sunday afternoon to kind of talk about running and, you know, gave a really good insight into his training, into his kind of dealing with a serious stomach condition that he's kind of managed since he was a teenager. So yeah, really good, really good, really, like I said, really, really interesting. Good insight and another good interview.
Well, thanks, guys. Thanks very much for everyone who's listening as well. We really hope you enjoy the interview, and we hope you've been enjoying the show, nearly up to 20 episodes now. Let us know what you think about the podcast and drop us a message on social media if you're enjoying it. If you're not, just send your messages to Robbie. see you in a couple of weeks when we have an interview with Verity Ockenden. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Thanks.
So this week on Track, we're excited to talk to one of UK's fastest current male athletes, Jack Gray. Jack has proven to be a versatile athlete on the road, track and country, and excelled at all distances from the 800 metres up to making his marathon debut at the COVID Secure race in London last year. Jack has represented England on the road, GB on the track, and is currently running for the high-achieving Cambridge and Coleridge Club under the coaching of Mark Vial. Thanks so much, Jack, for giving up your time today to talk to us on the podcast. How are you?
Yeah, good to join you guys. Yeah, I'm doing pretty well considering where we are in the world. And yeah, but you know, always smiling. So yeah, good, cheers. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, it's probably worth saying actually, just to give a bit of perspective, because this might not be released for a few weeks, that we are we're recording in on January the 31st, which is obviously in the height of lockdown, on a Sunday afternoon as well. So Jack's been good enough to give us his time on a weekend. So have you been out for your long run today? I presume on a Sunday, Jack.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, managed to get out for 20 miles this morning, so that was nice. Although It's been so wet and saturated that there's only sort of, there's only one trail left to run on that you won't fall on your bum on. So it was good, but I'm hoping for some drier weather so I can get out and start mashing up the trails again.
Do you still? I read a couple of years ago that you're always trying to do your long run on the soft ground. Is that still the case?
Yeah, I mean, my philosophy on running is just if you can run soft, then sort of run on the soft. I mean, I try and do at least 50% to preferably up to 70% of all my runs on soft ground, like apart from a session. So yeah, I only managed sort of 9 of my 20 on soft today, but it was, yeah, it just I think it's so important to take some of that pressure off you, and also when you're running on the trails, you get that variation in gait, and you also get that variation in foot strike, which I think just sort of balances the load over different muscles a bit, and also it's just nice to get off the busy streets. So yeah,
I always think when you hear kind of Americans and Australians talking about how much running they do on soft ground, kind of compared to the UK runners as a whole, I think they must look at us and just think, kind of crazy runners, kind of hitting the concrete at every opportunity. So
definitely, no, all for soft ground runs, mate. All for soft ground.
So so to start with, we'd like to give our listeners a bit of context really in terms of I suppose your standard, Jack, and how high your standard of running is. So if it's okay with you, I'm just going to kind of bang through some of your PBs.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah,
notable performances. Obviously, if I've got any of these wrong, then just jump in and kind of correct me. So start off with the 800, so that's from 2010. So you ran a 1:56 at a BMC at the Birmingham Uni. 1500 again, 2010, 3:50, which is another BMC event at Stretford. 3000 in 2018, 8:03 in Watford. 5000 on the track, 5000 meters, 2019, which is 14:02 at the MK 5000 PB Special. Followed that up with 10,000 meters on the track at 28:49, which is the night of the 10,000 PBs, which is also a night that you ran for Great Britain. And then kind of moving on to the road, so 5K 2019, 13:47, which is Twilight 5K Ipswich. 5 miles 2019, 23:46 at your Preston 5. 10K 2019, 28:57, which from what I can find was tied between Brighton and Telford. Seems that the record, the kind of record makers seem to give you Brighton as your PB on power of 10.
Oh, wow.
I'm not quite sure why.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe some prejudice towards the South, I'm sure. But, I'll take the Midlands as the PB, there you go, at heart.
We'll get on to that later. and then your half, 2019, so 63:15 at Valencia. And then your first marathon attempt this year, 2:20:26 at London, which was, like I said, your first attempt at the marathon. Which is your kind of standout PB there, Jack, if you could pick one?
I think standout in terms of how I feel about it is probably the 28:49 on the track, because that was at the Highgate, night of the 10,000s, which is also the European Cup 10,000 metres, and obviously just wearing the British vest and to run like a decent PB, but you know, you can't really get better than that. So yeah, I'd definitely go for the 10,000.
Such a great event, isn't it? The night of the 10,000s.
It's so good, and such a shame to see it obviously cancelled again. But yeah, hopefully in 2022 we'll have a proper event with all the crowds back. But yeah.
And then if there was a PB that you're kind of looking to improve, I think I might know the answer to this one. Which one's kind of in your focus going forward?
In terms of what's in my focus, I'm not currently sure, just because of the whole world seems to be in flux and it's just hard to know what to plan for. But I mean, obviously, the London Marathon I did this year, which is the first marathon I've done, as you say, and with the 2:20, obviously for me that was a pretty disappointing performance, and mainly due to an injury, to be honest. So yeah, it was this good. If I want to improve any time, I want to sort of brush up on my records, it would be the marathon, yeah. But I'll just have to see in terms of how we go forward, whether I do decide to go back to it. But yeah, it'll be interesting to hopefully in February and March when we have some more context to what we might be able to do this year.
You're actually thinking about reconsidering kind of sticking with the marathon, or because I know at one point that was kind of quite a big focus, wasn't it, and a big goal for the next 3-4 years.
Yeah, I definitely labelled it as a goal, but I think in the last year, over with the COVID pandemic and the you've suddenly gone from being able to race wherever you want and race all these amazing events to basically having very slim to no pickings for most people. And it sort of impressed on me the importance of just doing running to it just to enjoy it. So when things start to open up again, I don't want to have the trouble of the marathon, as it can be a bit overwhelming as a goal and it can compromise your fitness in other events. So I'm thinking, do I want to have that kind of go into that cycle of marathons where your whole year is aimed at two races? Whereas before, if you sort of look at my power of 10, I'd probably be averaging like a race every 2.5-3 weeks, which is quite a high kind of load of races, and I do really like racing. So I'm going to be weighing that up and over the next few years, because actually the most important thing for me is running is a hobby that I really enjoy. And if focusing on one big goal means I can't have that enjoyment on a sort of a week-to-week basis in terms of racing to the standard of the light, then perhaps it's not necessarily worth pursuing. But at the moment, I say I'm just it's all a bit in flux, so we'll have to see how it goes in the next few months. But yeah, I'd definitely like to improve it at some point, though, is a short answer to that question.
That's a really interesting perspective on, and kind of shines a light really on how this weird time in the pandemic has kind of changed people's goals and outlooks. Like, you might talk to one person who's now kind of decided to focus on the marathon, and you know, it's kind of affected them in that way. But I suppose I've never really thought about, exactly like you say, when the curtain comes up, hopefully the chance for us all to race, it's kind of got to be grabbed with both hands, because you don't really know what's around the corner, do you? So
exactly, yeah. So it will be really interesting to see that. It'll be interesting to see how people approach it as well, because we've all had this time to time to not racing, where you don't have to ease down, and people have been getting really fit. But it's, I suppose it depends, you know, what form, as we say. But yeah, hopefully spring will be good, and we'll all be putting our racing shoes on.
The vaccine will work, and it'll all be fine, I'm sure. I mean, it's probably worth. I mean, now we're kind of talking about it, I was going to kind of pick your brains about it a little bit further on, but just about the whole experience for London 2020, because obviously you got to be a part of something unique really at that time in terms of the kind of COVID secure environment, and it obviously created a lot of interest and a lot of excitement in not just the running media, but kind of the media, you know, the national media and the worldwide media. I mean, how was that experience?
I'll add some asterisks to my answer before I start. It was obviously a massive privilege to be invited to compete, and it was in a very select position when other people didn't have the opportunity to race at all. But frankly, sort of being in a hotel for 2 or 3 days, not being able to go within 2 or 3 meters of anybody, and sort of staying in your room for most of the time, it's pretty rubbish. It's probably the answer. It's like, imagine the boredom of race day when you're sort of, you've got a race at 9 o'clock at night, for example, and you've got to sort of sit there all day, and you're trying not to move as much. And you're just sort of killing time. It's all that for 3 days, and I think I took my work laptop and did work in the end, just because it was just take my mind off things. But yeah, there was really good British guys there to chat to, but like the ability to socialise and speak to people was sort of reduced, and it was people were keeping an eye on it as such to try and reduce any interaction. So yeah, it was a bit rubbish really as an experience. It was brilliant to be a part of, but not like an experience you'd want to sort of repeat very often. So yeah,
Did you get a kind of sense of being at the centre of the kind of running world in those couple of days before, or was that just kind of lost in terms of the kind of like exactly like you said, kind of how sterile it was and what how boring it was basically?
I think you definitely got a sense that the world was actually, and the wider world was actually sort of looking at this race as kind of a spectacle of the bizarre, in a sense that it was, it's just a bit weird. Like you've got the little social distancing monitor necklace type things, which are basically little necklaces with monitors on. And if you came within a meter, it beeped really frequently. And if it came within 2 meters of someone, it gave you a slightly less aggressive beep. And it was all that kind of, social distancing technology. And I think at the time in October, there was a sort of a, there was sort of, we were still, we were in that, still in that hopeful period that we sort of maybe got over the worst of it. I think a lot of people were. So it was like, oh yeah, look at all this new technology we've got, and we're starting to do all these COVID secure events, and this is the future. And there was a lot of hope around that as well. So I think it was a bit of, you got a sense that you were being sort of viewed by the wider world as like a bit of an example of how we might progress out of COVID. But it was yeah, it was certainly weird, and obviously there wasn't, not much focused on like the on like any of most of the British guys, because you've got Kipchoge and stuff in your hotel. But yeah, it was still cool. It was still cool. My CV.
It's interesting looking back now, isn't it? You're absolutely right that even in the space of kind of 2 or 3 months, we seem to have gone kind of massively backwards in terms of optimism. And, exactly like you say, it felt like that was the kind of start of the kind of moving out of that period and kind of looking forward for races. And now kind of back to square, well, worse than square one in a way. I mean, in terms of your own race on the day, I mean, I'm just kind of taking a punt here. I presume you're kind of, from what I can gather, you were kind of going out for qualifying time for the Commonwealth Games, potentially 2:14 pace, and got a bit of a, you were dealing with a, was it a calf injury or a hamstring injury?
Yeah, so I yeah, that was probably, your summary's probably about right. Sort of yeah, 2:40. I mean, the context of the day was that it was an absolutely miserable day, and so windy, 6 degrees, and tipping it down. So I think when you're on race day, you've got to try and neutralize those negative thoughts. But in reality, no one will ever run that well in those conditions, just because those aren't good running conditions. Yeah, I was carrying a calf niggle that I'd sort of sustained 5 or 6 weeks before, and I've been sort of running through it, resting, and then building it back up again. And yeah, it was always a risk to sort of start with it, because over the marathon, any of your niggles will be exposed, because 26.2 miles is a bloody long way. And yeah, ultimately, after sort of about, I got to sort of the half marathon, sort of 67 something, and feeling pretty good, but with a calf starting to niggle. And then it was, yeah, in the next 3 miles, it really deteriorated. And maybe I shouldn't have finished, but I did finish and sort of ran in at my sort of almost steady pace for the last 10 miles, just to say that I finished that marathon, because I don't like dropping out of races, even unless it's absolutely going to kill you, kind of thing. So it was a moral victory at least. But yeah, obviously not the performance that I was hoping for, but that's running. So yeah, it was still good to get to that finish line and say that I've finished the weirdest London marathon in history.
Potentially the most famous London Marathon of all time as well. So,
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
I mean, kind of jumping back to your, because I mean, you've got quite a kind of long history really of within the running world. So you were kind of quite a prestigious kind of running junior for Birmingham Roe Heath. Can you kind of take us back to kind of what got you into the sport and that kind of progression that you made as a teenager?
Yeah, I think my story is not particularly unique in terms of how I got into the sport. My dad's runs for Birmingham Roe Heath, now Birmingham Running and Triathlon Pratt, and took me down to the club. And there was just some really motivated good people, such as Nick Price down there, who was running a good junior squadron. And luckily for me, there was also a guy called, some people will remember, some won't, the notorious Paul Thompson of Birmingham Roe Heath. And we were good training partners, and we were really good at pushing each other on. So it was effectively my dad took me down, I enjoyed it and had fun with some good people, and then it sort of grows from there. And I think that's where, you know, all performance type athletes generally start, is enjoying the sport and enjoying the company, and then enjoying the taste of success. So yeah, that's pretty much where it started from.
Did you have a moment in those years where you realised that, I know you said it was a hobby at the kind of start of this chat, but where you realised that it could be a bit more than a hobby in terms of the level you're going to be punching up?
I mean, yeah, I still see like national level athletics performance that I have, that the sense that I am are still a hobby, really. It's I've always thought I might be able to get into a major championships, but even as a junior, I wouldn't ever aspire to be like a full-time athlete. That lifestyle never really appealed to me. I've just always enjoyed the sensation of running and how it makes you feel, and the kind of ferocity of competition and how how it's sort of captivating that is, both from when you do well and you don't do well. So yeah, when did I realise I could do? I might be able to step up. I think it's probably some like early performances at sort of like the school's level, when you sort of go to sort of the regional level, like West Midlands for me, and you start to realise you're winning the West Midlands type 1500s or 800s or whatever it was then. And you think, oh, you know, actually, if I step it up, I could be, you know, I could get a national medal. And I think, although you say I was a high performing junior, I was like a reasonably performing sort of under 13 and early under 15, and then from like the top of the under 15s to under 17s, that's when I sort of changed my mindset a bit and started focusing a bit more. And that's when I started to see those sort of top fives at nationals and cross country, and started to get those sort of national medals. But I think I didn't start off being absolutely sensational. I've always had to work, and I think that kind of developing that work ethic through the enjoyment has been really important for me.
Yeah, so I mean, looking kind of back through your results, I mean, the couple that kind of stand out from when you were a junior are kind of around that 16, 17 year old. So kind of running a sub 4 1500 as an under 17, it's pretty kind of rapid. And then obviously winning the London Mini Marathon in 2010 as an under 17.
Yeah, that was a good one, actually. Yeah, like, that was always a good event, that. Yeah, going away with your mates for a little jolly around London. That's a great event, the Mini Marathon. Recommend any juniors to do that event. I'm not sure what it's like anymore. I assume it's the same. But yeah, it was definitely a good fun weekend.
Were you aware of some of the people that you kind of beat on that day? So looking through the results, obviously Ben Connor in fourth, Mark Scott in 19th.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the time, I think it's strange in a way, because a good thing about athletics is you do tend to grow up with the people that tend to go on to, you know, relatively great things. And I've always, for example, always raced from a junior level, always raced Ben Connor and been quite close to him on a number of races. So I suppose at the time it was just like, I mean, not consistently he beat me more times obviously than I beat him, but it was like racing those guys, I think it's sort of normal, and they're all really nice approachable guys as well. So it's sort of like, yeah, I don't, you know, obviously trained with Mark Scott quite a bit and know Ben Connor from races fairly well, so yeah, it's just like it's almost like racing with like friends, really. So yeah, and they're still approachable, nice guys now, so it's not like they've changed. So it's that's a good thing about running as a sport, is even the top level athletes, I'm talking like, you know, European like level British athletes, tend to be extremely approachable, especially in long distance running, and they're not sort of segregated from society, whereas a cricketer or a rugby player or a footballer of the same level would be protected by sort of layers of whatever, like, you know, agents or whatever, you know, would be able to reach them. But, you know, I could Facebook message Ben Connor probably now, and I'd probably get a reply if he could be bothered. So, it's quite nice, really, that about running.
We can, we can vouch for that on the podcast, because when we started it, we had kind of lists of people that we'd like to talk to and interview. And, you know, the likes of yourself and some of the people that we've talked to kind of, especially recently, were just kind of in our wildest dreams, but then we realise that, you know, you're all so approachable in terms of kind of talking, and exactly like you say, there aren't those layers of kind of difficult to kind of access, or, you know, like agents or whatever it might be, or of arrogance that you might get in other sports.
No, definitely. And I think that in part that's negative. It might be a product of the fact that there is just not any support for, well, not much support for athletes, despite it being one of the, you know, biggest participation sports and most, you know, anticipated sports, the Olympics, for example. But relatively, there isn't an effective model for enabling these people to sort of have professional lifestyles off it. So yeah, there's a good side of it, which is the, as you sort of say, the openness and niceness of every people in the sport. But this other side of it is, unfortunately, to get to that level, most runners will have had to sort of pay their own way partly. So yeah.
And I suppose create their almost their own publicity sometimes, which is completely different to other sports as well.
Exactly.
Talking about Mark Scott, I mean, that's a nice kind of introduction to kind of, so when you moved from Birmingham to Cambridge, I presume that was for work.
Yeah, so I finished my master's at the University of Birmingham, and then I came down to Cambridge for a job. Yeah.
Okay, and that obviously gave you the chance to run for Cambridge AC, which is kind of where Mark Scott and also kind of many other brilliant athletes run. How did you kind of transition into Cambridge? Was it feel kind of naturally moving from Brat, or did it kind of feel like a bit of a step into coaching and training?
Yeah, so in terms of how I transitioned, I think I came to Cambridge as sort of, yeah, not knowing anybody. And so I think like a month into starting my work, I basically, you know, went down to Cambridge and College Athletics Club, to the track there at Wilberforce Road, and then started training with them and got to know everybody. And the good thing about Cambridge and College as a club, it's especially the Mark Biles group and all the other coaches who in that kind of middle distance, long distance area, everyone's sort of quite well integrated and it's really friendly. So that was really nice, coming to a new city, using running as effectively a you know, a kind of trampoline to bouncing into new social groups, etc. Yeah. So I think I'll probably train, not knowing I'd be permanently in Cambridge for an extended period of time at that point. I think I sort of trained with Cambridge for a year. And then I think Mark Vile probably every half an hour of that year was texting saying, oh, when are you going to join? And I think when you get to the point that you've been training with a group for a year and you're pretty established in the city, that's when you think, actually, well, I've trained with this group, I'm part of the city, and that's when I should join. So it was just a natural progression. It wasn't based on, oh, Cambridge and College are going to be great, let on, I want to win some medals, so I'm leaving Brat. It was more, I live in the city, I train with them, they're my friends, so I joined the club, really. So yeah, that's how I approached it, which is just seemed like the natural way to go for me.
How's it been working under Mark Vile? Do you kind of link in with him kind of closely, or just take bits of advice? I mean, is he right in your schedule?
Yeah, so I mean, I think way I approach training coaching has always been kind of laissez-faire, in the sense that I've been lucky enough to be around a lot of great coaches from at Brat and then at Birmingham Uni and then at Cambridge. And since I've probably been sort of 18, 19, I've pretty much sort of set my own schedule, but always just done whatever the group session is in the area. So I go to Mark, I sort of know what I need to do. But then I go to people that I trust for advice. So for example, Mark, I go to Mark to speak through things with Mark. I'm lucky enough to live with my fiance Becky Hare, who's a physiotherapist and all-round wise person, so she's quite good at reining me in, which is generally what most runners need. It's actually, most runners need to be told to run less to be successful, which is seems like a bit ironic, but it's generally true in my eyes. But so Mark's really helpful for advice, and then I've got Becky as well, who's really useful from a sort of a physio strength perspective. So yeah, that's probably how I approach it.
Because you, I suppose you're always quite well known for kind of low mileage variety of training, even kind of playing maybe other sports or just concentrating on your kind of strength and conditioning work. Is that still your kind of outlook in terms of the mileage, or have you kind of increased it since being down in Cambridge?
I probably hadn't increased it notably since I've been down in Cambridge, apart from pre-London Marathon last year, where I thought, obviously, you know, you're running a marathon, you do need to run mileage. So basically, I think what I've learned from the marathon is that I did need to increase my mileage for that event. I only run 6 days a week and six runs. It just suits me to do, like, I don't like double days. I don't like it taking up my time. I don't particularly like having to sort of lace up my trainers twice in a day. So I think I've gone back to my learning point from the London Marathon was to sort of go back to my six days a week, but with a slightly higher mileage at present, just while I'm figuring out what it will be. But if I decide I want to go back just to focus on more 5K, 10K cross country, then I'll probably drop back down in mileage again. But I'm sort of keeping my, I'm training like a hybrid runner at the moment. I'm keeping my options open. Say, for example, I've done a 20 mile run today, but I'll be doing like 5K, 3K session in a week in a tempo kind of thing. So yeah, just keeping my oar in different parts.
Staying fit and strong, basically.
Yeah, definitely.
I'd say you've had your strongest years while you've been at Cambridge, the 2018 and then 2019, especially kind of when you look at your kind of PBs and where you've kind of peaked. I mean, what I also didn't mention at the start is finishing sixth at the National Cross Country in 2019 and then also winning the Midland Cross Country Championships. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on kind of what contributed to making 2019 such a strong year? Was it kind of a amalgamation of different things, or was it one kind of specific thing that changed for you at that time?
I think the two key things for me is because the start of 2018, I was doing my Masters and I sort of put the running on a back burner. So I really wanted to focus on my Masters. After I finished out and started work, everything became more routinized. You've got your kind of 8 or 6 work schedule, whatever. And that gives you that time where you can actually, you're not working to 11 o'clock at night to do your Masters. You've got that kind of structure. So it was training consistently, training, most importantly, the second point after the consistency is training with a high quality group in the interval based sessions. So, you know, when you can do 2 or 3 high quality sessions with people who will push you, you just get to improve quickly. And that was it for me. It was pretty much a really strong training group where I'd be doing sort of shorter work where I've got some rapid juniors kind of chasing me down on 400s. And then I've got like people also who can like take, you know, cope with like a, you know, a longer tempo with me. And I think that period was consistency and lots of people to just push you. So that's probably what I'd say it was, really.
I know that in the past you've had quite a high profile, I don't know if injury is the right word really, but you've had an issue that certainly affected you in previous years with your running. Now, I've obviously never heard of this before, and correct me if this isn't the right kind of name for it, but you suffered of a stomach condition of median arcuate ligament syndrome.
Yeah, so MALS, MALS, the condition it's not a stomach condition as such. It's an ischemia. So effectively, what's happening is I'm not getting enough oxygenated blood to my gut area, my intestinal area, and that's causing effectively cells to die down there, and that, you know, to starve of oxygen, that causes pain. So what effectively happened with me is that the ligament part of that condition, that ligament, median arcuate ligament, is pushing on one of the major arteries that comes down from your heart. That restricts the amount of blood you get, and that causes the lack of oxygenated blood to the gut. So I still have that condition. I had a major operation to try and release it, which did improve it, but didn't work fully. And because everything can grow back and reattach in different positions when they cut stuff away, but to summarize quickly. So every time I do a session, and quite often when I do a run, I am forever coping with the looming spectre of stitch. Pretty much, I'd say I've had it twice this week, just in my sessions. Usually, I can tolerate it through trying to make sure that the pace is consistent and that I'm having enough recovery, and most importantly, by like making sure I'm eating the right things at far enough time away. But yeah, unfortunately, that injury for me has always been there because it's a genetic condition since I've been a junior, and still is here. So it really affects how I race, train, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, is that a factor in kind of how you've kind of approached your training over the years in terms of kind of, I suppose, that lower mileage maybe, and that's kind of stuck with you?
I wouldn't say this is the lower mileage really as a result of that. I think what it's made me realise, in a way, it's been actually, I've used it to my advantage because I've realised that if I want to perform at the higher level, I have to sort of train harder than other people, in a sense, because I know that even though when I get this stitch pain, it's effectively when I'm reaching that lactate threshold, when, you know, basically making all that acid, then you're sort of converting back, and you're starting to effectively fatigue. I know as soon as I get into that position, even if my muscles feel fine, I'm at risk of stitch. So what I've had to realise is I basically need to ramp up my blood lactate threshold to as high as I can in order to perform at that level. So in a way, it's given me the motivation to say I really need to be like tenacious in my training so that I can get really fit, so that I've got almost a bit of a comfort blanket in a race where I know that I'm a bit fitter than other people, because there's always a risk that even if I am fitter than them, that I get the stitch because the race has gone out too hard or whatever, and that sort of ruins my race effectively. So yeah, it's quite an odd way of looking at it, but actually in a way the pain's made me train harder, so I sort of have it to thank in a way for my attitude to training, which is, if you've ever trained for me, people who train for me will probably tell you that sort of Jack puts himself in a hole effectively quite readily. I'm used to pain, and I'm used to like the pain of my stomach, and I'm conscious that I need to train harder in order to get that buffer. So I'm quite good at putting myself in the pain zone as such.
It's funny you should say that, because one of our very best runners from the club I'm at, Worcester AC, joined Cambridge, Ben Jones, last year.
And
he we asked him kind of what he likes to train with, and he pretty much said exactly that. Yeah. You're an animal, you'll just kind of run yourself into the hole. So I mean, obviously you seem to be kind of looking at it from a really positive kind of mindset, but have you ever got into a position where you just thought it's just not worth it and kind of considered jacking?
Yeah, probably twice. So at the end of my undergraduate degree at Birmingham University, I remember I was focused on my degree, so training wasn't going as hard. And I remember everyone convinced me to do box, kind of, because, you know, it's a great event. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. And I remember just doing that, like, at cross country, at the box nationals at Cheltenham, I think it was, and just being in bloody pain for 6K and just absolutely grinding it out. And it wasn't pleasant. It was raining. It was like, you know, nipple deep mud. And I remember just finishing that race and thinking, well, I'll absolutely be done with it. We got the medal, and like it was, I think I came like 15th or something. So it was a great grinding performance. And I think, you know, I got some kudos for it. But I just remember finishing thinking, absolutely stuff face. This is rubbish. And I did actually sort of quit the running. Quit the running for like, I don't know, like 2 or 3 months, and then people generally tend to come back to it because it's something you enjoy, and yeah, built that love up for it again. And then probably the same happened like at the time of masters as well. It was like a time of stress, a time of wanting to achieve as high as I could in education, and just thinking, just going to put this on the back burner and, you know, settle down and just sort of do my masters and then have a bit of a, you know, party time during then. And then, yeah, and then that, after that party time, finishing my masters, when I started was when I moved to Cambridge, and that's when I sort of, you know, got that love back again. So no, I'm not, I've definitely had two major crisis points in running where I'm just like, I've got to the point now where running is not what I said at the start, a hobby. It's a burden, and I'm not enjoying it. If I'm not enjoying running, then I shan't run effectively, because I don't think you should ever be doing anything. You shouldn't really ever be doing a sport unless you're a professional, perhaps. If it's not fun, if you're not looking forward to going and putting your running shoes on, yeah, you know, should you be going out?
That's a good mantra to live by, isn't it? It's exactly that. If you're not enjoying it, then it seems a daft thing to do, really.
I'm not perfect, definitely. I'm not saying that it's necessarily the right way to go, but I do think there is, for runners, like, it's one of those sports that can be addictive. But you've just got to sort of temper that addiction with the fact that it is ultimately a sport that you do because you love doing it. And that's what I try to keep at front of mind, so that I keep on the right track, really.
That gap you said that you had from running, it might lead into kind of, it might shed some truth on this kind of next point I was going to raise with you. I can remember running the Worcestershire and Warwickshire County Champs are all on the same course on the same day. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it's 2016 or 17, but you won the whole thing, but obviously the Warwickshire County Champs. And I remember people saying that you hadn't even kind of laced up your shoes for a few months before because of your kind of condition. And you've just kind of gone out there on race day and kind of beaten everyone. Is there any truth to that?
I'll have to look back. But yeah, that period of time was, I was definitely, wasn't not running. I was running, but I wasn't training that hard. I was like, I think what I did in that period was I just sort of rock up at maybe one interval session a week and do a couple of other runs, and then that was just keeping it ticking over. I think that was more of a I'm doing my masters, I want to smash this kind of time. But yeah, I didn't just sort of rock up out of bed, but yeah, it was definitely a low time. I always say I'm not amazingly talented as a runner, or not as talented as some, but in terms of genetic capability, perhaps. But what I have generally got is I've got a good work ethic, and when I do, and a good work ethic in terms of training, when I focus, and then also in terms of when I do race, I probably will always eke out at least 95% of what I'm capable of, which is, I think, important as well.
Because based on kind of what you're saying as well about kind of the stitch kind of always looming while you're running at a fast pace, I can't kind of find any real DNFs in your kind of history, so which gives me the impression that you've just kind of run through the pain and always kind of got to that finishing line.
Yeah, I think I probably have had a couple where it was sort of when I was younger, I was sort of 15, 16, I think I had a couple of DNFs, just because it was, I think, you know, when you're, it's all, maybe younger than that actually, but because when you're in pain, you don't know, at that time I didn't know what it was, and you just, and when I was, that pre-operation, it really was intense, horrible, sharp pain, and very difficult to stand up straight with it. So I wouldn't say I had a perfect track record, but as a senior, yeah, I will always. I don't think I've ever DNF'd as a senior, which is, I think, is important, because, you know, people get pressures about what their power of 10 looks like in terms of, you know, I want to look good in every race I do, but it's just not honest, is it? And I think if you've got a bit of a social contract to finish a race if you entered it, I think, especially for your teammates. But always finish your races. That's a rule for the podcast listeners.
I think if there's one thing I'm going to take away from this, it's that a race is a social contract. So I'm going to start living my life by that. So in those dark moments. to kind of move on to a bit of a lighter subject, it was your kind of brush with, I suppose, like the mainstream national media, which was in 2018, and you when you won the Cambridge Half, which obviously that's no massive surprise. But then the story was because you ran under your boss Andrew Rawlins' name as a late entry, and you won in 66 minutes. And obviously, I don't want to take the story out of your mouth, but then obviously you told the organisers at the finishing line, who obviously kind of disqualified you. Somewhere on the line, the national media, not just the running media, kind of got hold of this story. When did it kind of dawn on you in the race that a commotion could possibly follow?
In the race, I suppose when you're in a race, I guess what I'd done is because I hadn't really, I'd had emailed the organisers to say that I was planning to do it, and that someone had given me their number and can I run? I sort of didn't get a response, and then I'd sort of said that I'd pace someone round, and said, oh, you know, I can do 10 miles, whatever. And then I went out. I think I was up in Birmingham actually the night before for a university reunion, so after you've had a few pints, kind of thing, and you think, oh yeah, I'm cock of the walk here. I'll go over 10 miles tomorrow at 5:10. And I got 10 miles tomorrow at 5:10. And he sort of, oh, everyone was sort of dropping off. And I was like, oh, I can. You just get 3 miles to go in a half marathon. You're feeling good. You just got, you just sort of finish it. And yeah, I think you realise after that you've. I said straight away, I'm not running under my name and disqualifying me, etc. But yeah, I think it was probably not until, I didn't think, because it's such a minor story, effectively, someone runs under someone else's name and wins a half, a relatively relatively low key half marathon. I never expected it to take off like it did, but I guess it was a quiet news weekend, so it did, and it's quite a nice story in a sense for like the national media to get hold of, because it's because of course it became, I ran into my boss's name, it wasn't actually my boss's name, and that I was kind of I never even run since PE, and I'd suddenly run a half marathon. It was that kind of narrative. It just plays really well. So and I got asked to go on quite a few national radio and TV programs, just to have it like a small interview, which I did sort of turn down in the end because I didn't want to feel the fire and get myself into trouble. But it was incredible when you sort of get in, and also weird to work out, get a taste of what it's like to be sort of a footballer or something at a very minor level, because people just get your contact details and you sort of get phoned up. And I remember getting phoned up by a national radio station, whom I shan't name, and saying, they said, oh yeah, do you want to do an interview? And this was sort of on sort of Monday morning, sort of 7 o'clock, I'd just woken up before going to work. I said, oh yeah, I'm happy to do an interview. And he said, okay, then I'll just put you through to Chaz and Dave on BBC Radio Star. Like, no, probably was a national radio. And I remember just literally in 10 seconds, they just throw me on the national radio with no agreement at all. And it was just like, it was so funny. But yeah, it was oh well, it gave me a bit of a reputation anyway, and probably played in my favor in the long term. But yeah, it was a good weekend, interesting, let's say.
Did you like when you're in that moment, in like a couple of weeks after or a few days after, how bogged down did you get in looking at people's kind of reaction of it and stuff? Because kind of when I was kind of going back through the story, obviously in preparation for this interview, it's quite addictive, kind of, even for me, kind of in preparation, reading the comments and like seeing what people's opinions are. And like, I think if I was in your position and it was about me, I don't think I'd sleep. I think I'd just be kind of addicted to kind of reading these comments and kind of going through it. How did you kind
Yeah,
of deal with that?
I think I did have my phone was absolutely pinging off the whole time. So it was, yeah, I was aware of it, but I think the golden rule of anything is never read the comment section of any newspaper, because it's just full of it's just full of extremely opinionated people on both poles. So I was either going to be a goblin or I was going to be an angel. It was one of the
Yeah.
two. So I pretty much knew that I'd read it and someone would call me an absolute legend, and the next comment someone would come and call me scum. So yeah, I think the only bad thing of that is that somebody from the local area did try to contact my employer and try to initiate some kind of disciplinary procedure against me, which
Really?
I have no idea why. Apart from I didn't actually know. I don't have an idea why. So someone did actually someone from Cambridge area who's a runner did actually effectively ask my employer to start some kind of disciplinary procedure, which was when I actually start to get it serious and had to speak to that person. Of course, my employer thought it was quite funny and did not, of course, discipline me for anything. But yeah, there are some malicious people out there. So yeah, you definitely. It does give you a taste of what it's like for that half a day or day period or whatever it was, and what it's like to be someone who's really under pressure. So yeah, it was weird. Of course, there's not even any prizes at all for the Cambridge Half Marathon. So it's not like I pocketed. If there was, well, yeah, I definitely would have obviously not taken it firstly. But yeah, I couldn't have gained selection, I couldn't have gained money, I couldn't have. The only thing gained is obviously a bad boy reputation, but you know, that one existed, so it was
you can't give that back, can you? That's priceless, to be fair.
Exactly, no. So yeah, it was a good laugh for everybody, and the organisers say it won't agree with me, but definitely their race got a load of promotion and they sold out a hell of a lot quicker for the next year's race.
That is, yeah. I mean, the element of that story I didn't know as well is that you've been kind of having a few drinks the night before. It brings a kind of Dave Bedford kind of angle to it, doesn't it? So it makes it even more exciting.
I just go, like, a couple of pints is fine, isn't it? But yeah, it's just to see my uni mates, and I think getting a train back from Birmingham to Cambridge, I was like, oh yeah, this would be a good idea. And you always think everything's a good idea when you've had a few pints.
Where are you at the moment in terms of kind of looking and training for 2021-22? I mean, are you as relaxed as you kind of say you are in terms of just training, and or have you got certain kind of benchmarks that you're going to be looking at in certain races?
Yeah, I think, again, in terms of the long-term goal, I've always got the idea of the Commonwealth 2022 Games on my mind. And I think I'd analysed previously that the only feasible event I could qualify for was the marathon, based on the number of places potentially available and where I think I'd be able to get a place effectively. So that's still on the cards. But I think, as I sort of alluded to earlier in the interview, especially after the London Marathon, the last year was just showing me that I really love cross country. I really love running for my club and doing road races and track races. I like doing everything. And you know, you're only a runner for so long, especially at a certain level. So I don't want to compromise any of that. So at the moment, I'm taking what I said before, like a hybridized approach to training. I'm training in a way that I feel like I could go out, you know, in a month's time and knock out a good solid 5K and take all 10K. And I could also go and run like a decent marathon. So I think I'm going to continue like that for the next sort of 6-8 weeks, just to see how things open up. And I'm really going to take a sort of a, hopefully we might have something to hold on to by the end of, should we say, February. And at that point, then I think I know I'm strong from a big base of miles in the marathon and keeping those miles up. I know that I've still got my hand in the speed work. And then at that point, I'll decide what I'm going to go on to do. I'd have really loved to have done some cross country this year. That's what I'm missing the most, because it's just the best event. But yeah, at the moment, let's just keep my hand. My philosophy is keep your hand in, and we reassess in 6 weeks or so, pretty much. Yeah. So sorry, I can't tell. I don't have a structured plan at the like of goals at the moment, just because of the flux nature of it all.
I think in terms of kind of long term as well. Obviously, you're kind of right side of 30, so you know you've got plenty of years to kind of revisit the marathon, I suppose.
Exactly, yeah. It's the only reason I was ever thinking about the marathon was because of I've never had a desire to do a marathon. I never really wanted to be a marathon runner, but it was just the notion that it may be the easiest route to run at major championships, and more specifically to run at a major championships in the best city in the world, Birmingham. It's the idea of running in your home games on the streets of where you grew up, kind of thing. I mean, it's to use a cliche, it's what dreams are made of, isn't it? So that's what gave me that kind of, that would be good. I reckon you could do that kind of thing. But yeah, we'll see.
Okay, look, I mean, this has been absolutely brilliant, Jack. We're just going to, if it's okay with you, I'm just going to finish with some quick fire questions, which we like to kind of fire at all our interviewees.
Yeah, go for it, yeah.
So if you could go for a run with one athlete, dead or alive, who would it be? And that doesn't have to be a runner, that could be anyone.
Haile Gebrselassie. Seems like a nice, he just seems like a really nice guy, doesn't he? Like every time you see him, he's got a smile that's beaming like through the ear to ear, and he just seems like a good guy. So yeah, I'd have a run with him.
Beautiful. Such a beautiful runner as well, wasn't he? So
big contrast to me, yeah. So
I wonder who would start falling into the other one's step, whether he would start kind of mimicking you.
He'd be overwhelmed by my aura, so he'd just have to fall in step with me.
Track, road or country?
Cross country.
Yeah, nice. Favourite race that you've ever raced?
I've got to say, any national road relays at Sutton Park, because they're just great, aren't they? So yeah,
100% agree with that. Favourite long run or favourite place to long run?
Lickey Hills, Birmingham.
Least favourite session?
Turn around 200s. Basically, run 200 really, 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 really hard, sort of times three, have really long breaks in between, and make it all about swimming in lactic acid.
Okay. Oh,
just awful. But good for you. Do your speed work.
Do your speed work. And then the last question, which is the most important question as far as I'm concerned, which is what's the best Birmingham rave venue?
Oh, wow. Bloody close down now. I always loved the Rainbow, but that's gone. So unfortunately, I'm not sure if there is an answer to that question at the moment. God bless the nighttime industry, but I'm sure that the creative class and the kind of young people out there will have something sort of cooking up in the next few years. But yeah, it's so depressing at the moment. I'm desperate to go out. Absolutely desperate. Yeah. Missing that.
Rainbow Rooms is the wrong answer, by the way, Jack. It's a Q Club all the way.
I do like a Q Club, but too many good experiences at the Rainbow, too many good memories, if I can remember them.
Like I said, I can't thank you enough for giving up your time, especially on a Sunday afternoon when I'm sure you've got better things to do. Just to kind of give you a shout out on Instagram, so
RaveRunner93, I think. Sorry, I'm absolutely blooming useless on Instagram, but I think it's RaveRunner93.
Once again, Jack, thanks so much. All the best over the coming months, and obviously we'll be watching closely to see how you get on when all of this is kind of over and you're back to racing and racing at your best. Thanks, Jack.
Yeah, same to you as well. Yeah, have a good one. Stay safe and all that.
Cheers. Yeah, you too. Take care, mate.